Welcome into another edition of Lexington Stories, Lore, and More. I'm Alan Lytle. My co-host is Lexington author Fiona Young-Brown, where we uncover the stories and lore behind some of our most fascinating spots and quirky spaces. Just for edification, Fiona is the author of Secret Lexington, a guide to the weird, wonderful, and obscure. It's available through Reedy Press, and it is pretty much our source, our go-to source for this material.
It's been a good sort of background source to get us started, and then we'll maybe splash out in a few other areas.
So. Yeah, yeah. Once we've exhausted all possibilities.
Exactly.
But this is a great book. And, you know, we can plug this. It makes a great Christmas gift for somebody who maybe wants to know a little bit more about the town in which they live, or you're trying to attract someone to come to this wonderful town.
Exactly. If you're putting together a gift basket for those out-of-town family members, you can give them this, and then when you get bored of them 2 days after Christmas, you can suggest they go and visit all the places in the book.
Well said. I was going to say, like, maybe some bourbon balls to go with, but, you know, your idea actually has a little bit more merit, I would say. All right. All of that aside. Last month we said that we were going to tackle this particular topic, and it's kind of the ways that Lexingtonians have gotten around since its founding in 1775. So the first thing that comes to mind is water.
Yeah, the funny thing is when I first moved to Lexington, I remember someone telling me, you know, Lexington's a really unusual city because it's not on water.
Except for the town branch, but well, that's later.
But course. That yeah. was it. Everyone, yeah. you know, people kept telling me that there was no water running through Lexington. And then obviously later you discovered that there is. There's the town branch, but now what makes it different? I mean, it's obviously much smaller than, you know, rivers in a lot of major cities. But the fact that it was covered up. And so, yeah, it's very easy to come to Lexington and think, huh.
There's no water
here. There's no water here.
Au contraire.
Exactly. We just hide our best secrets.
And so what was the impetus for that, for covering up the town branch?
As best as I can tell, it was actually to make a sewer system. And to this day, it's still kind of a key part of the sewer system. And I think, you know, obviously when we look back at Lexington's history and things like the cholera epidemic and so on, so much of that epidemic came from the town branch, for better or worse. You know, having that one water source in the town, it provided everyone's drinking water, but it also provided everyone's waste water and sewage and so on. Maybe that's why we drink bourbon so much. Who knows? Because we're still dealing with the after effects of knowing what was in that water. I promise it's probably cleaner now. But so...
Well, so supposedly, that's what why King Solomon lived.
Exactly. That was why he beat it, because he wasn't out there drinking that wonderful, wonderful, wonderful water. And so I think, you know, it kind of made sense to then cover that up as a sewage system to just prevent that kind of thing from happening again.
Now, I understand, though, that the town branch, when it was more or less exposed, mm-hmm. was this staging ground for a very important invention.
It was, and it was something that I had never heard of. It's really hard to find records, which I'll explain in a minute. But, yep, down by the town branch was the demonstration ground for the first one of, actually probably the very first steamboat. And I should say it was a model steamboat, not a full-size one, in case you're looking at it and wondering how on earth they managed to fit that down there.
Indeed. Yeah.
It was actually the model steamboat. And that was back in, well, it was a man called Edward West, because as you kind of learn if you look at Lexington's history, we had a very enterprising bunch of inventors that all settled here over the years. And I think part of that was necessity. you know, you kind of had to learn to make what you needed. And he designed a steamboat. This was before steamboats were a thing. And so in 1793, he dammed part of the town branch along where the James Pepper Distillery is in the distillery district. And he built a miniature version of his design. And apparently, you know, this, I mean, this was the kind of event that the whole town would come out to see because someone's testing this new kind of boat. They all came out, they all cheered for it, and so on. And then he went to patent it. And obviously, at that time, there were actually several other people all coming up with similar designs, one in Baltimore, one in New York, and so on. And he ran into funding difficulties. So by the time his boat was actually made, then, or by the time a full-size version was actually made, several others had been patented and had gone into production as well. But he did create one that later made it all the way to New Orleans. That was not until 1816, though. And in the meantime, another one had been, you know, gained the patent, had sailed up the Hudson and so on. But then to make matters even worse is that there are really no models, no notes, nothing left of his designs because there was a huge fire in the patent office in D.C. in 1830-something. And that destroyed all of the records. So it's strange that we know he did this.
How do we know that? Was it printed?
Literally
accounts?
Through a little snippet in the local newspapers talking about him, you know, running the tests and so on. So there are a few little tiny clips in newspapers every now and again saying, he did this test yesterday. People all came out and watched. This was incredible. And then a little bit later, he's filed a patent and so on. But we don't have any idea as to what it actually looked like, how it worked, whether it was the same as the others. It's just all now completely lost to time, history, and fire.
But we do have the story, which we're talking
exactly.
about today.
Exactly. Luckily, thankfully, because of local newspapers, we do have that little story. And it's just kind of a throwaway little clip in one of the newspapers. You know, a bunch of people gathered yesterday at Town Branch and cheered on Edward West as he demonstrated a steamboat. You know, which was just a big, exciting new creation at the time.
Okay, and from there, we got to talk about the Valley View Ferry because it, too, is a boat.
And that is even older. So, we were talking about the town branch and Lexington forming up around here. But a lot of the earlier settlers, even way back when, were out in Boonesboro. I mean, Fort Boonesboro we know about. And so that was down on the Kentucky River. And so a settlement also grew up around Valley View. And it's funny because if you go down there now on the other side where the ferry crosses over the river, there's a few houses, there's a little church, there's really not much else. But at the time, that was a community. There was a time when that was a community of about 500 to even as many as 1,000 people. And because of where it was on the river, you know, that was an ideal spot for transporting goods and so on. And so in 1780, you had a lot of the early settlers in Kentucky were Revolutionary War veterans. And after the war, veterans were given a land allotment. They were allowed so many acres of land that they could then go on. And so he was pretty high ranking, John Craig. And so he got a large land assignment down Boonesboro, Valley View, and so on. And he had the idea of, why don't we create some kind of a ferry? We need to get goods across this river. A ferry would be a great way to do it. In 1785, the state of Virginia, because at that point we were still Virginia, said, go ahead. And there's been a Valley View ferry there ever since. It's the oldest continually operating business in the whole state. There are a few other ferries in various parts of the state, but this is the oldest one. And it's fascinating to me because it's such a simple little trip across the river.
Was it hold about three cars or something like that?
I think three cars and the trip takes 3 minutes across. And the river's actually not very deep there. Apparently it's only 11 to 12 meters deep. And so it's, you know, it's pulled by that little pulley thing on the rope. But it's still such a key piece of transportation. It's so simple, you don't think about it. It's free of charge, by the way, for anyone who wants to go down and try it. But it, I mean, even now, if you think, if you don't take that ferry for 3 minutes, you have to drive up to the interstate and all around just to get down there. You know, it's kind of a very a roundabout way of getting somewhere that can take much, much longer.
So it's still vital.
It is still vital. It was privately run for the first 200 years of its existence. I think the local government took over in 1991. And so now it's Madison, Clark, Fayette counties kind of operate it together with the transportation cabinet for the state. Apparently, I reached out to them when I was writing the book. They told me about 53,000 cars per year cross using the ferry.
That's amazing.
Which comes out to, they estimate, about 80,000 people. So it is still clearly very much a useful, vital part of the local transportation. And I think, you know, during the winter, we're getting into that point where you'll start seeing news reports on the Valley View Ferry can't run today because the water's too high or so on. And, you know, for those people who use it, that is a major snafu in their travel plans, shall we say.
They have certainly to, a major consideration.
Yes.
About how am I going to get to work or to the grocery store
exactly
today?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so that is, as you just mentioned, the oldest continual running business in the entire state.
Yep. And it's kind of nice and hypnotic to just go down and watch it. You just stand there and look down as it crosses, and then it crosses back. And
amazing.
It's fun to watch and an incredible history.
Another claim to fame for Lexington. And that's kind of what, you know, what this podcast is really all about with Lexington stories, lore, and more. What about horses? Now, we know that they race, but they're also a vital source of transportation at a certain time in our history.
They are. And sorry, you say horses, and all I think of, is it possible for anyone from out of town to come to Lexington and not have to say horse and point every time they see one?
Horse capital of the world, as a matter of fact.
But yeah, I think we've kind of forget it's, you know, now we think it's kind of quaint and charming when we see the mounted police riding through downtown occasionally or over at Hamburg and so on. But we kind of forget that at one point that was the way to get anywhere. It would definitely add on a significant amount of time to any journey. I know when I was reading about the train line and it said how that the inaugural train trip from Lexington to Frankfurt was considered fantastically quick because it took 2.5 hours, which gives you an idea of how long it must have taken by horse to make that kind of trip. And even where we are now, you know, driving in and around Lexington, you suddenly realize that so much of this was farmland 100, 150 years ago. And so even getting into downtown, which we now take for granted as a quick 10-minute drive or whatever, might have been a whole day trip for someone who was coming in without the road system and maybe, if they were lucky, relying on a horse as opposed to walking. But either way, you were looking at a significant trip.
And what comes to mind is stagecoaches. What do we know about the transportation, the mass transit of that time, before trains even came along?
Yeah, it's, there were so many different, I love the term stagecoach, by the way, because it always reminds me of the Wild West or something, you know, very exciting, much more than horse and carriage sounds kind of tame, but stagecoach, exactly.
Yeah,
one of the things I realized that was kind of confusing for me and probably for anyone else who comes across it and doesn't know about it is that the early stagecoach system in Lexington was called the railway.
No way. Really?
And so when you hear about the early railway or the early Lexington Railroad Company and so on, it wasn't trains. It was stagecoaches, a few trams, and so on. And then apparently at one point they realized, now we have trains, this is confusing people, so they changed it. And then, as far as I can tell, at one point they changed the name back again. So I think Lexingtonians were just possibly continually confused as to whether people were arriving on train, stagecoach, however else they chose to come in.
Yeah, I could totally see that. And now when trains and streetcars did enter the picture, mm-hmm. I mean, talk about the growth of that and the birth of railways and how that curbed maybe the isolation of Lexington.
Yeah, I mean, those, I think it's really important to see what a huge step forward that would have made just for everyday people being able to get somewhere. You know, we were talking about how even a trip into Lexington from the outskirts would have been a major undertaking if you had horse or if you had to go in by foot. And then you had the stagecoach, which allowed you to go longer distances. But that in itself would have been considered quite a trip. You know, that wasn't something where you just thought, let's hop on a stagecoach for the day and go out for some fun. You know, this was a major trip that would have required planning and a certain amount of expense, so it wasn't available to everyone. And the same with the trains. When they came in, suddenly you have an easier or definitely quicker way to get somewhere. I know for those of us who now drive to Frankfurt in half an hour, you know, 2.5 hours by train may not seem that great, but at the time, that was a major step forward. And so suddenly you had a way for people to be able to communicate more easily, to travel more easily, not necessarily incredibly easily, but definitely compared to what they were used to. Suddenly a trip to Frankfurt that might have previously taken multiple days to get there could be done and feasibly back again within a day. But that also meant it was easier to transport goods. You weren't waiting quite as long for supplies and so on. So that allowed for businesses, for construction. So it really kind of all fed into, I don't think any city the size of Lexington could have grown up to the size it is now without that level of kind of infrastructure growth, railroads and so on, to be able to bring goods and people in.
And where were the tracks in Lexington, in the area?
Well, this is what is always interesting to me because, you know, growing up in England, my grandfather worked on the railroad, so I'm a railway junkie. When I'm home, I travel by rail. I lived in Japan and traveled by rail, and the railway station was literally right outside my apartment. And then I came here to the U.S., and I love Amtrak. I traveled around the country once on Amtrak. But the lack of local trains is something that I really miss. There's something about just being able to hop on the train. You don't have to deal with traffic and all of that. It's just comfy. You sit back. And so I do miss seeing that here. At the same time, I have this really, you know, driving around Lexington, you see all of, obviously there are still train tracks here for freight and so on. Mm-hmm. But there were, at one point, passenger trains. And it's amazing to me, and this is a sign of how much downtown Lexington has really changed, that up until the, I think 1960 was when it was demolished, there was the main train station, Union Station, on Main Street. And so the train tracks would have gone right down where it's hard to even envisage a train now. But yep, Union Station was out on, if I remember correctly, what is now Martin Luther King Boulevard and Main Street. So I guess where the giant parking structure
and
Helix County Clerk's office
and all
and
of
so
that
is.
Yeah, yeah. And if we're wrong about that, folks, just let us know. we'll do some research on
and
that.
And so you really could just come into Lexington on the train, literally step off the train, and there were shops, restaurants, the big city as big as it was in those days. But yeah, that's incredible to me to think that it was right there in the heart of Main Street and downtown, and that now it's there's really no kind of remnants of it along there or anything that I can that I've found or that I've noticed.
Yes, and historians do point to just taking up of those tracks and how that transformed downtown and maybe sort of opened it up again to sort of more vehicular traffic as well. So it definitely transformed downtown, and a lot of people were hailing that as, you know, something that needed to be done, and it was overdue to take place. So, but, you know, obviously railroad and rail passengers, they had their heyday in this town.
Definitely. And when it first opened, you know, when the railway first opened, I like, by the way, the train, that the first train from Lexington to Frankfurt, the one that took 2 hours, 29 minutes at an incredible speed of 12 miles an hour. In 1835, and it was appropriately named Daniel Boone.
The that makes
engine
sense.
Was the Daniel Boone. but so, yeah, by, I mean, by 1860 or so, Lexington, there were train tracks connecting it to Paris, to Louisville, to Covington, and then from there, obviously, further afield. So that was a huge thing at the time. But then, yeah, you know, fast forward another 100 years, and cars are now the way of getting around rather than trains.
Yeah, I'm not sure if Americans will ever be broken out of this idea that my car equals my independence, whether or not it should be that way. It definitely, we are a car culture and have been forever.
Definitely, and it's for someone who grew up in and lived in non, I mean, obviously, cars are now becoming much, much bigger and were a big thing. But, you know, as a child, I grew up and it was not unusual for a family not to have a car in England. When I go home, my mother doesn't drive, has never seen the need to. And I never actually drove until I moved to Lexington, because everywhere else I'd lived, there were trains, there were buses, you could walk. There was just no need. And then you move to Lexington, and pretty quickly I realized I can't walk across New Circle Road. Have you seen how crazy that is?
People drive really fast.
And they
don't obey they don't obey the traffic laws as well. Well, I want to get to that. Describe the first time that you had to get your license. What was that like then?
I actually took my license in Iowa City, because I was living there just before I moved here. And I realized that when I moved to Kentucky, to Lexington, I would need a car. And again, Iowa City was somewhere that I really didn't need one, because it's much smaller, buses and walking and so on. But before I moved here, I knew I needed my license. And my husband just gave me one piece of advice, which was get it in Iowa. Because at the time, and I don't know if it's still the same now, I think now don't they have to go out to Leestown Road to take the test and get the license? But I know at the time he said the first part of your driving test was you go to the county clerk's office and then you had to drive down that spiral at the Helix. And he said, you don't want to do that. You really don't want to do that with someone watching every move you make.
No, I mean, that makes me nervous just trying to do that.
So I actually took the test in Iowa and then moved here. But I remember the very first time I was driving down that spiral thinking, who designed this? Why? I mean, now I'm used to it, but yeah.
And now you understand.
Now I'm glad I took the test somewhere else.
Well, speaking of cars, let's talk about the development of New Circle Road and what that meant to getting around Lexington.
Yeah, I mean, wow. I should say I actually love New Circle. I don't always like driving on New Circle Road.
Yes, yes.
But the actual layout of it, I think, is brilliant. When I first moved here, Everyone told me you can't get lost in Lexington. If you can find your way to New Circle Road, you can find your way anyway. You know, that basically once you were on there, and it is, it's a wheel around the city, and every spoke
takes
leads
you downtown.
Into downtown.
Yeah.
So from that perspective, I just think it's an easy, great way of getting around. And so it always amazes me when friends from Louisville come and say how confusing it is, because I find driving into Louisville and all of those very avoidable if I can do something
why,
else.
Why can't there be a wheel and
just
spoke
one big,
in Louisville?
Exactly. Yeah. The wheel system is perfect.
Yeah.
So it's very practical. And it's, I mean, talking about the way Lexington has grown and grown and grown, it's hard now to imagine that at one point that was all dirt and farmland. And what was it? The Beltline.
The Beltline. That's what they originally called it? Was the Beltline?
The Beltline, which was the plan. And back in the 50s, it was just kind of a dirt two-lane track around part of town, and they had this idea to develop it, that it seemed like it would be a good road to avoid making everyone have to drive through downtown.
Almost a bypass, if you
exactly,
will.
Yeah. That kind of.
Sure.
And so it's hard to imagine now when you're driving along it, this was once, which is why it's great if you find old pictures of, you know, when the Parkette first opened, and it's just kind of a little diner in the on a dirt track. You really see what they mean. And so, yeah, the very first section was completed in 1952, and that was Newtown Pike through to Richmond Road. And so that was known as the Northern Belt Line. And I love all the different names as well, because some people I still hear call it the Belt Line. Some older people.
I've heard people say Circle 4.
Circle 4, which confused me as well. I used to, a lot of Japanese that I worked with when they came to the city would always talk about Circle 4, which I then eventually realized, okay, they're talking about New Circle Road.
Mm-hmm. And what about the old circle? Where was that?
Exactly. So that was the first section. I think it was finally officially, the entire thing was officially opened in 1967. And that was kind of, and this was the other funny thing, because at the time that was kind of the boundary of Lexington. We wouldn't need to go any further. Lexington would never grow anymore. And then, you know, I guess within 10 years, there's Man of War.
Yeah.
And now it's expanding beyond that and so on. And so pretty soon, New Circle Road will no longer feel like kind of on the edge of town.
No, it feels like it's right the heart.
It is really
of metropolitan Lexington.
Although I've noted Lexingtonians still kind of define themselves or discuss where they live, where they're going and so on by, is it in or outside of the circle?
Right. Yep. You inside the circle? Or you outside the circle? Or are you outside of Man of War? Whoa, you're really
you're out there.
but yeah, and it is the circle of demarcation, really. If you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
But it definitely improved our way of getting around. I guess so much so. I think the latest statistics, and it's been this way for a while, but the average commute to work is actually 20 minutes in the city.
That doesn't surprise me, because I'm trying to I know a lot of people really complain about Lexington traffic and so on, but compared to a lot of places, and the traffic here is really not that bad. I'll duck for any hate mail that comes in.
Well, it's relative.
Hard, yeah, I mean, it's hard to think of anywhere. I mean, even I live over near Beaumont, but even getting over to Hamburg, unless you're going in the middle of Christmas rush hour or something, yeah, you hop on New Circle and it's about 20 minutes. So it's really an easy. There's nowhere in town that I'm planning to go that I suddenly have to think, oh my God, that'll take me an hour or whatever to get there. So.
Okay, so you mentioned Beaumont. Describe your experience of, traversing the double crossover diamond structure they got out there.
You know, now I don't even think about it. And it's so much easier than when it used to be the stoplight. We used to live, when I first moved to Lexington, for years and years and years, we lived in the Hamburg area. And my in-laws lived over off of Man of War and Harrodsburg Road and so on. And so that would be our typical way of going to see them. And I just remember that light and the traffic there. And then they opened that double diamond, and I remember the confusion. Everyone saying, what is happening? Who's going where? Why are we driving into one another? What do you mean we're driving on the other side of the road?
Wait a minute, I want to go right, and I'm going left.
Exactly.
And then all of a sudden, and I'm shooting over there.
And now it's so easy.
And there's going to be another one soon on
Leestown. When they finally do all that construction mess that I'm avoiding desperately at the moment.
I believe we did reference that in our last podcast.
We did, yep.
About that. But happy to report, though, that all access points are now open or reopened to Leestown Road. So
that's good to know.
So. Yeah, it's an ongoing thing. So
I think the double diamond is one of those things, you know, the same as when they first brought in roundabouts or traffic circles to Lexington, which again is something that I grew up with, but everyone's like, what are they doing? And I noticed they've painted, I mean, I love the roundabout on Wellington Way.
Oh, yeah.
Heading towards Fayette Mall. But I think they've really run out. How many more road signs can you paint and flashing lights and everything to tell you this is a circle, this is what is happening? And
invariably, though, somebody
and somebody
is not paying attention and you got problems.
Exactly. So,
yeah. So that's kind of the yin and the yang of traffic. We have more people, and it's the traffic engineer's job to sort of figure out a way so that we can improve the flow and get where we're going with as little tension as possible. And it's not always achieved.
I do have to wonder how they do that, you know, just figuring out. I mean, every single light is just, you know, to get them all synchronized, but then they don't have to be synchronized in a certain way. Yeah, that's not a job I'd like to do. So.
Well, and now I want to circle back to buses and mass transit, because we still have mass transit today in Lexington with Lextran. But talk about the advent of buses and the introduction of that into Lexington.
You know, I'm trying to think when buses actually arrived in Lexington, and I don't know off the top of my head exactly.
But we know the Greyhound Terminal.
Yep, there was the Greyhound Terminal out on, there was one out on New Circle Road when I first moved to Lexington. I'm not sure, is it still there or has it moved somewhere else now? I have no idea where you'd go if you need to get a Greyhound bus.
I believe it was. Not sure if it's still open or not, but I know it's out there near Russell Cave.
Okay, yeah, that was the one.
It was out there by Russell Cave.
I did the Greyhound once and swore never to do it again. So.
Leave it to me to bring up an old.
But that's another story.
A traumatic memory there. You're triggered by that. But
I mean, so you had the great, obviously, Grey Line Station. Which now is
just wonderful, you know, marketplace.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that was built in 1928, I have just reminded myself. And that was the hub for Southeastern Greyhound. And then Lextran took it over in the 60s. And then after that, they moved downtown to where we know, which I think obviously seems to be a much more centralized location for Lextran. So they're now downtown, and now obviously Grey Line is the big shopping center, restaurant, kind of really a hub for developing that part of town again.
But that was the place where they washed the buses, correct?
It was, yes. And you can still find, there are great old pictures. Well, and even if you visit today, you can still see how it was once obviously some kind of a bus station or something, you know, all the doors and so on the Loudoun Road, on the Loudoun Avenue side. So that was where they all went for washing, mechanics, storage, and so on.
And that building was, well, dilapidated for a time,
mm-hmm.
and certainly had fallen into disrepair.
Yeah.
And now it has found a new purpose.
Exactly. And beautifully so. I mean, in terms of the design of it and really kind of keeping with what it was, but also updating it for a new purpose. But I do like, you know, especially in the summer when they can open the big garage doors and have the whole side of it open for people to congregate and stuff. It's a nice, it's nice that they've done that instead of demolishing the entire thing. I always like to see buildings repurposed like that.
All right, so we move now from wheels to wings, and I'm doing the spread eagle thing right here on for those of you who
can't see. It's magnificent. For those of you who can't see this, I believe he can fly right now.
Well, let's talk about the aviation history of Lexington. Obviously, we have Bluegrass Airport. At one time, it was called Bluegrass Field, but mm-hmm. that's not where the first airport was.
No, and we were talking about, you know, the Leestown Road and the new Double Diamond that they're putting in on New Circle Road there. And the first airfield was actually out on Leestown Road at that area. There is a historical marker, but it's in the middle of a median, in the middle of the road, so do be careful if
don't
you want
stop
to see
and
it.
Don't stop and think you could snap a
no,
picture there.
No, do, you know... Be careful. Remember, there is traffic. But yeah, again, going back to when all of that was farmland and so kind of remote. But they decided that that would be a good spot for the first airfield. The first recorded plane that we know of landed there in 1921. And I think my guess is probably it just landed. I mean, it was an open space, flat, a good spot.
Looks like a good place to land.
Exactly.
Right now, today, yeah.
And then there was apparently a local World War I flying ace who set up a small company out there, kind of a flying circus at times. He would fly in and out for private passengers. By 1927... they had built the first little airport there. There were a few commercial flights because, I mean, at this point, let's face it, this was still very much a fledgling thing. So when we say commercial flights, we mean a person with a plane flying someone else, possibly.
You're brave enough. Give me the money. Hop
sure,
on board.
Sure, we'll give that a try.
we'll see what happens.
That thing will get up in the air. although I do like the idea of the flying circus that apparently visited quite often. And then there was Charles Lindbergh who visited. He originally wanted that to be a secret.
That he was going to fly
into
Lexington.
That he was flying into Lexington. He was just coming in to see some friends who owned farmland around the property, and so his idea was that he would just fly in, nobody would notice, and you know, and I think one of the people who worked in like the hangar of those days was probably a shed or something, but got excited about it, realized it was Charles Lindbergh. By the next morning when he went to leave, you know, crowds of people had all come out to watch him take off. And I found this great story because Lindbergh nearly crashed in Lexington. And I don't think that's a claim to fame that we would have wanted.
No, certainly not.
Apparently, it was a really windy morning when he was leaving the next day. You had this whole crowd all gathered to see him. There wasn't much of a runway. He apparently said later, you know, it's a little too short. Too many trees and so on. It's not ideal. But so you had all these people and the wind, apparently this side wind came in and, you know, I mean, you know, we're talking about the little biplanes of the 1920s. One of those gets caught by wind. And I found an eyewitness chatting about it years and years later, but telling the paper, you know, recollecting. And they were just a child at the time. They said, and I remember seeing him getting in the plane and everyone cheered as they thought he was going to take off. And he started down this little runway and then the wind just blew it off track and it veered into the bushes. And everyone's cheers sort of turned into this collective gasp of, mm-hmm. what's going to happen? But obviously he corrected himself, he took off and so on. And luckily Lexington did not become the place where Charles Lindbergh met his end.
Didn't he clip a tree on the way up?
He did. And that was one of the things later on he said, you know, this, I've flown in and out a lot of places. This is not going to be ideal for developing, you know, for future flight and so on. And so realizing that he had a point, there was another airfield opened in 1930, and this was called Cool Meadow.
Cool Meadow?
Cool Meadow, which sounds nice. Very laid back. And that's out where Fazig Tipton is now. And so there was an airfield out there that opened up. And that one proved to be a little more practical. And so pretty soon after that, then Halley Field, which is the one out on Leestown, that ended up just kind of closing down. Nobody used that anymore. But then we get to Bluegrass Field, and that came about because of World War II.
Tell me about that story.
So there's war going on in Europe. They kind of know it's only a matter of time until America gets brought into that. And there is a need for bigger airfields. You need places for troops, supplies, and so on. And so it was recognized pretty early on that there was going to be this need for a bigger airfield in or around Lexington. And so that was when they took, I think it's like 530 acres over on Versailles Road. Like everything up until this point, it feels like a common thing we're saying. It was farmland, which it was until it was developed. And so the government took that over to develop an airfield, like I said, for military aircraft and so on. That opened in 1942. And then after the war was when they realized, okay, now what do we do with this? We have this airfield. This is much more practical than the one out at Cool Meadow and all the little ones. We've got this built and so on. And so after the war was when it then fell under the ownership of the city, became Bluegrass Field, the commercial airport. And so they launched commercial flights from there. I think really in the 1950s was when that kind of developed. But even through the 60s, it was still a very small operation in terms of flights coming in and out. I have to give a nod to James Bond, of course, because, you know, Sean Connery and Goldfinger and the scenes filmed out at Bluegrass Field at the time.
Okay, now we're talking about the Pussy Galore's air squadron.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so that's where they were landing, and the scenes from the hangars.
Yep.
That was also
that was
Goldfinger.
Out at Bluegrass. Yeah, and so, you know, we have our claim to fame there. But yep, so the current airport, obviously it's been expanded again since then, extra runways, and now I drive past it and I think they're constructing more parking, which is desperately needed out there. And now it's a major part of Lexington's transportation coming in and out. Plus, it's got that beautiful approach down over Keeneland.
Yeah, yeah.
I love that approach into the airport. But it really came about because of World War II and realizing we needed more military. And then, obviously, after the war, changing its use.
And so now we have this wonderful airport. You can connect wherever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not a lot of direct flights. But you can certainly start your journey at Bluegrass Airport.
Yeah. I mean, you can fly from there to Detroit, Chicago, Atlanta, the big three for then, you know, reconnecting to somewhere else. The flights to New York, if I recall correctly, have started up again. And then obviously all the smaller airlines doing either little local hops or the travel kind of routes, you know, down to Florida. Do we still have one to Vegas? I think maybe.
We'd have to check on that.
I remember when they rolled that out. Some of them run certain times of the year only and so on. Although I have to say, I'm kind of glad because it was the most pointless flight ever, but I also, there's something about it that I missed was that little tiny flight up to Cincinnati.
Oh, really?
Did you? I don't know if you've
never taken that, no.
It was, I mean, you'd get up in the air, you'd take off, and then you'd be flying for all of 5 minutes before they'd say, and we're now descending into Lexington.
Please tell me they have stopped that, because...
they did. They stopped that some years ago, but I remember even... when was the awful plane crash out in Lexington?
Comair was...
They were still doing the Lexington to Cincinnati flights then.
That was August 27th, 2006.
Yeah. They were still doing the Cincinnati flights then because family was actually supposed to be on one. But yeah, they've stopped those now. I think they realized... I don't see how that could have ever been... financially practical.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, all of this is, I guess, the big takeaway from our conversation today is that Lexingtonians have always had a need to get around, and some of those methods have been improved upon, and some have remained the same, a la the Valley View Ferry.
Mm-hmm.
And we just continue to grow, and so that means the need will only get bigger as well.
Exactly. I think, you know, you can't have the Lexington that we have today that has grown to this point without all of these changes and developments of transportation. You know, if we were still running just with horses, then Lexington would be a very, very different city today. If we were still managing just with steamboats or trams and so on. So, you know, it's fascinating to look at how each of these, some of them were definitely considered strange when they were first introduced. Others were considered, you know, a very welcome look to the future. But I think every one of them played such a key role in really kind of spurring on growth of the city and development and more amenities and so on.
There's been talk, too, of like... maybe a bullet train between here and Frankfort and Louisville and Cincinnati. And I don't know if that's ever going to get off the ground, but, you know, you see that, though, in Europe.
Mm-hmm. It would, yeah. I mean, it would be nice to have a train between here, Frankfort, Louisville, Cincinnati, and so on. I definitely enjoy riding the train, and so it would be nice to see it. Again, like, as you say, practically, will it ever happen? I don't know.
Is the political will there?
The will, the willingness to spend the kind of money on upgrading tracks and everything that would be needed. And I guess, you know, then we'd need a train station again in Lexington. What are we going to do?
Well, and that, they continue to talk about, and there's a plan on the books about improving New Circle Road over mm-hmm. there by, I guess, in the Bryan Station and between Family Circle and Bryan Station, if memory serves, that stretch of roadway, Circle 4, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah, and that part of New Circle, I mean, because the part on the south side is very separate from everything around it. In, you know, there aren't houses directly on it and shops direct. Whereas that's on the north side, yeah, it's definitely a very different road. You've got a lot of stop and go traffic, a lot more shopping, commuter, residential, and so on. So I kind of do wonder how they'll improve that if they can. The other thing is, you know, we mentioned Man O' War. As the city expands, they keep building additional roads around it, and especially with all of the construction now out at Hamburg and so on, I wonder, will there be a day when Man O' War is developed into a full circle around
right.
town?
Will or, it be you the know, outer the, loop of Man O' War and the inner loop of Man O' War?
Will we need something else outside of Man O' War? Where does it all end?
from above, it just looks like a giant bullseye.
There you go.
That's kind of... Well, I guess on that note, we will leave it. But today and every time our guest has been Fiona Young Brown, and she is the author of this great book called Secret Lexington, A Guide to the Weird, Wonderful, and Obscure. If I don't see you until the new year, well, happy new year, and of course, happy holidays.
Yes, happy holidays, happy new year, happy 2026, and
yeah,
all of that wonderful stuff.
And we're going to go into the 251st year of Lexington. Thanks again, Fiona.
Thank you.